The following talk was given by Steve Matushak at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on June 7, 2020. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Great to see you, and I hope that you're well and that you're safe. It's been a trying few months that we've had here. And I think, you know, when we're in a situation like we are, at least in the States here right now, where there's been a lot of unrest and things are, I think what we want to think is they're starting to settle. Excuse me. That now the unrest is over and things are starting to settle. But I think if we really look at what's taking place, we realize it never really settles. It doesn't stop. It doesn't return to something. It's still unfolding. Events are still unfolding. We still have to do something. And then that question comes up, well, now what do we do? Or what can I do? And I think those are great questions. If you think about it, there are actually questions that come up for us probably every day when we just go, now what do I do? Now what can I do? They might not seem to be in the same scale, but whenever our expectations of reality don't meet reality, whenever what's going on right now isn't what we thought was going to go on, that question arises. Now what? Now what do I do? Now what can I do? And again, it can just be something pretty small, like you didn't expect you were going to lock your keys in the house, and you did. I don't know if this has ever happened to you, but I have one of those doors where when you close the door behind you, you can actually lock yourself out of the house. You know, and so maybe you didn't expect it was going to happen, and you have to be somewhere in 5 minutes, and it's a five-minute car ride. You know, and there's something that you didn't expect is going to happen, so now what do you do? So like I said, this question kind of comes up for us on a daily basis when we encounter reality when it doesn't seem to be the way we thought it was going to be. And so we find ourselves in a situation like this that perhaps was unexpected. Perhaps it wasn't unexpected. One thing I would also invite you to do is if things are going exactly as you expect them to, is to really be with that. To see that, because how often are we ever 100% right about what's going on, right? So we get a kind of a rough estimate of what's going on in the world, and we act out of that. And a lot of times that can be helpful, but then that rough estimate, boom, something happens and we find out it's not very accurate and we're back to, now what do I do? Now what can I do? So as far as a question about what can we do, what can I do, I want to recommend people listen to Steve Hagen's talk from last week about that topic. I thought it was a really excellent talk. And helping us to see what the Buddha Dharma, what the teaching of the awakened say about what we can do. He reminded us of a verse that we chant in Sesshins. And Sesshins are meditation retreats that usually here at Dharma Field we have about five of them a year. We've had to postpone a couple of them now because of concerns about spreading COVID-19. But during those sessions, we recite a verse. Actually, a chanter recites a verse. And it's one that I think is a very profound teaching. Just to remind you, the verse is, may we exist in muddy water with purity like a lotus. Nothing surpasses the boundless mind. Thus, we bow to Buddha. And as Steve reminded us, we often think when we are perhaps faced with situations like we see right now, where it looks like there's something that needs to be done, we think that what we need to do is to purify the muddy water. So we might think what we need to do is go out into the world and then do something that we think is purifying the muddy water, or if we can't purify it, at least we're going to help settle the mud a little bit. And maybe that's what we can do at best, settle it just a little bit. But at worst, of course, we can churn it up. But what Steve reminded us, what I thought was really a nice pointer that he shared with us was that the lotus that grows from muddy water, it needs that muddy water to live. So even though we might want to purify the muddy water, we really can't do that. And we can't exist with purity like a lotus without existing in muddy water. And so what it is that we can do is when we can act either from the intention, and this is where it really gets important, is what is our intention when we act? In whatever we do, what is our intention? Is our intention to be awake? Or is our intention to do something out there? Perhaps something good, and perhaps not. And of course, you know, I just put good in quotation marks because we know from our teachings that the concept of good is provisional, that something that seems good in one situation may not actually seem good in another situation, or that something that seems to be good from one perspective, from another perspective, maybe doesn't seem to be good. And maybe something comes from good intentions, but the results may not, for the people we're trying to help, seem to be all that great. So I have been participating in a reading group with a bunch of people who tell fairy tales to children in schools around the Twin Cities as a tool to help children learn the skills of critical thinking. It's a really excellent program. The reason I'm telling you that is that just to kind of help us to see how our good intentions might not always look like they're so good from the perspective of people for whom we're trying to be good. And I thought of a story of, if you could imagine a giant wandering through the countryside, and that giant, she's crushing humans. She's just reaching down and crushing humans. And of course, the populace in that countryside, they're terrified. There's this evil giant who's crushing us, right? And then you discover, I don't know what they do. Maybe they finally wrap a lot of ropes around her. I guess I'm thinking Gulliver's Travels right now. And they tie her down. They find out that she actually was just intending. She saw these tiny creatures and they were moving from one place to another. And her intention had just been to help these creatures get to where they were going safely. So she was reaching down to pick them up, to move them to where they were going, just like I did with a couple turtles in the past few days that I saw trying to cross the road. And her large, large fingers weren't fine enough to pick the people up and crush them, sort of like a child might do trying to help an ant. And so good, again, is a provisional thing. It really depends on how we're framing things, how we're talking about things, what perspective we're looking at, what conditions we're talking about. So when we think we're going to do something out in the world, we think we're doing something sort of good, it's helpful for us to realize that, what I just pointed out. So then we hear something like this, and maybe we hear that teaching that maybe we exist in muddy water with purity like a lotus. And it seems to us then that what the directive is, what it is we are to do, if our intention is to wake up in each moment, is first then I have to wake up and then I can do something. And I still think that if you pay attention to the resonances, to the flavors, the overtones of what it is that you might have in mind, first I wake up, then I can do something good out there. So then we get this idea that there's this thing called being awake, right? So the intention is to wake up in each moment. Ah, well, then if I have that, then I'll have some kind of clarity and I can do good in the world. And you can actually see in that interpretation, which I think, again, is a common one. I don't know that we put it all together that way, that we sit and think things through like that. But I think it becomes an automatic way of responding to the way we're hearing teachings. But you can see in that a fragmented way of approaching the world. Now, fragmented way is simply, we can think, for example, that there's being awake and there's not being awake. And heck, we have teachings that I'm going to be talking about some of these teachings that say, you know, in each moment, we can be awake or we can act out of confusion. And so it sounds like there's two different things that are going on. There are two different things. We've got the world now broken up. And then we have me doing things. So now I'm separate from my actions to something out there. And you can just see that the world is fragmented. And I only point that out because, again, this is the way we frequently move around in the world, is it's broken up like this. But we don't notice that we've done that. So, again, it's an opportunity for us when we see that we're approaching life in a fragmented fashion like that. We can just see what it is that's taking place. But if we do think that there's this idea that, okay, all I have to do is wake up first and then I can do something good out there, you can see that this can also lead to an idea that then there are people out there who are awake or who have promised to be awake, who are somehow better. They are pure, like a lotus. But that's not really what our practice is either. I want to make that clear. I ran across a really rich teaching from Karen Mazin Miller. She's a teacher out in California in the Miyazumi lineage. And she's talking about, this is from her book, Hand Wash Cold. By the way, Karen Mazin Miller taught here at Dharma Field about 10 years ago as well, just in a weekend, giving some workshops and giving talks. But in her book, Hand Wash Cold, she talks about the fraught relationship she has with her husband. Or maybe fraught might be too strong. We'll just call it the lively relationship that she has with her husband. So they argue a lot, apparently. This is according to Mazin Miller in her book. And she says, you know, when the going gets tough, her husband will say something like, if people could see the way you really are, they wouldn't think you were so zen. And she replies, that's one thing we instantly agree on. I remind him that I don't practice meditation because I'm someone better. I practice because I'll never be anyone else. I read that and it really resonated for me. So again, I don't practice meditation because I'm someone better. I practice because I'll never be anyone else. And I would even say that you could say, I don't practice meditation because I'm someone better. Right? Someone who's pure like a lotus. You could also say, I don't practice meditation to be someone better. I practice because I'll never be anyone else. Now it's that I'll never be anyone else that I really want to look at a little bit more closely today as I reflect on, well, what is it? What can we do? What can I do? And what it is that the teachings of the Buddha Dharma help us to see about that. Because when she says, I'll never be anyone else, I think we can hear it in a certain way that's very ego-rooted. That's very much like, I don't know, I just suddenly thought, I know I bring up Seinfeld a lot in my talks, but I suddenly thought of George Costanza and the way that George Costanza refers to himself, right? George is going to be very angry, right? He talks himself in the third person. There seems to be this George Costanza. And then there seems to be a way that George Costanza understands himself as being in the world. And that's not what Mazin Miller's talking about when she says, I'll never be anyone else. She's actually pointing to something else. And so what I was going to do today was I was going to talk about this lovely poem that I encountered in a class that Warren Lang taught here at Dharma Field a number of years ago now. But as I started preparing this talk, as is frequently the case, I came across another text that really spoke to what I wanted to talk about in my talk today. And so I veered off at the risk, I think, it's one of the reasons why I was going to go with a contemporary poem, but at the risk of sounding like I'm climbing down that rabbit hole where people go, what is this going to do with my daily life? So I'm hoping that I can remind us that what this teaching is that I'm going to share with you today, how it is that it's pointing toward what can I do? And again, that's a question that we ask ourselves every day. So it doesn't just have to be in the situation we're in now, but it certainly applies now. That's the only time it can apply is now, because that's all there is is now. And what the teaching is, it's from the Dhammapada, which is a collection of Buddha's early teachings. In fact, a lot of Buddha's teachings are ascribed to Buddha, but it, really understand that they're written hundreds of years after Buddha had passed away. And so even though the conceit is that these are the teachings of the Buddha, there are teachings of Buddha and that they're teachings of Buddha Dharma. They're teachings of the awakened. But the teachings of the Dhammapada are ones that at least are understood to be transcriptions of oral teachings that the Buddha gave. Now, again, hold that with a grain of salt because centuries went by before anyone wrote these down. So they had to go through the telephone. If you ever had to play that game where somebody whispered something in your ear and then you whispered that to somebody else and then they whispered that to somebody. So it had to go through a telephone that went on for centuries. So keep that with a grain of salt. But there have been, my understanding is those tests they do, I don't remember what they're called right now, where they look at linguistic patterns to see if there indeed is an author, a single author behind a text. And there do seem to be suggestions that the teachings of the Dhammapada, at least in spots, come from a single teacher here. So, but the teaching that I encountered that really spoke to me as I was preparing this talk is chapter 12, self. And I'm only going to read a few of the verses. It's a fairly brief chapter anyhow. And then I'm going to talk about them. And I'm hoping I don't spend too much time talking about them. I have a tendency to do that. So, but the chapter is the self. And I'm just going to read an excerpt from it, the beginning and the end of this chapter. And I'll talk about what it is that the Buddha is pointing out here in this teaching. And again, hopefully connecting this back to what can I do? What can we do? If you hold yourself dear, guard yourself diligently. Keep vigil during any of the three watches of the night. Learn what is right, then teach others as the wise do. Before trying to guide others, be your own guide first. It is hard to learn to guide oneself. Your own self is your master. Who else could be? With yourself well controlled, you gain a master very hard to find. By oneself is unwholesomeness done. By oneself, one is injured. Do not do what is unwholesome, and suffering will not come. Everyone has the choice to be pure or impure. No one can purify another. Don't neglect your own duty for another, however great. Know your own duty and perform it. All right, so let me unpack. There are probably a few things in there that caught your ear a little. Just on, wait, what? Buddha just said that? So hopefully we'll get into those areas and get some clarity on it. So again, I'm just going to go through now verse by verse and talk to you about, kind of unpack a little bit about what Buddha's pointing out to us. So right at the beginning, he says, if you hold yourself dear, guard yourself diligently. Keep vigil during any of the three watches of the night. And, you know, at first blush, you know, if you hold yourself dear, guard yourself diligently, can almost sound like narcissism, right? If you love yourself that much, then, you know, be diligent and vigilant and don't let anybody, I don't know, steal that self or harm that self or injure that self. And indeed, if you look at that self from the standpoint of being ego, if you think of that self as something like, George is going to be very unhappy. Right? If you think of it in that terms, then yeah, you're probably talking a little bit about narcissism there. But if you don't look from that viewpoint, if you really, whatever it is that you're referring to as self, if you hold that dearly, and as I unpack this chapter, hopefully it'll soften that sense of self. If we have that ego, that idea of an ego-centered self, of a self that is born into this world, lives for a while, passes away, a self that is just me, myself, and I, that will soften as we look. And then we can see, again, if we just look at right now, what is it that we're labeling self? We don't have to get any further than that. is this dear? Perhaps some of us might say, well, not so dear. Right now, things aren't so great. But would you have it any other way? Maybe that's not quite the right way to ask. But the thing, I guess, that I want to say is, here you are, right? Here you are. And even when things don't seem to be that great, here you are. Last night, just for a little while, I had problems sleeping. I woke up. And it was so bright in my bedroom that getting back to sleep was a bit of a challenge. And I was doing that thing you do when you lie awake at night and you go, I just want to go to sleep right now. And then there's that agony of, you know, trying to sleep and then going, oh yeah, I shouldn't want to go to sleep, because if I want to go to sleep, then I'm certainly never going to go to sleep, because that's all that's going to be on my mind is going to sleep. So I heard a trick, by the way, I don't know if this works, that what you do is you try to stay awake. And you know how, like, when you get up in the morning and you're trying to wake up and you just keep falling back asleep. I don't know if that works. All I know is that for me, what ended up happening was suddenly the light in the room became present to me, and the sound of the birds that had been an annoyance to me that were keeping me awake. There was that right there showing up, and I let go of that being freaked out. I let go of that being annoyed. I let go of that suffering momentarily as I just was there with what was showing up. So here we are. And so if you hold that dear, guard this diligently. Keep vigil, he says, during any of the three watches of the night. And that's just, let's say, now. It's always. It's just now. Be vigilant always. Every moment, be vigilant. Then he says, learn what is right, then teach others as the wise do. Before trying to guide others, be your own guide first. It is hard to learn to guide oneself. So I get to this and somebody go, well, it sounds like you're saying that first you need to get enlightened before you can whatever, and in this case, teach. That's what it sounds like it's talking about. But especially if we think about that last verse, be vigilant always. Well, see, it's not really pointing to that. How is it, for example, that the wise teach? As he says in that first line, learn what is right, then teach others as the wise do. How is it that the wise teach? So at the beginning, he says, learn what is right, then teach others as the wise do. And I guess I want to first talk about what that right is. I do this frequently. I'll give talks or I'll talk about one of the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path, at least the translation that we use, uses right speech and right action and right livelihood. And so then I'll pause for a moment. I'll remind you that this right that's being referred to is not right as in right versus wrong. So it's not a dualistic way of thinking of things. It's not right versus wrong. It's not we have the right answer and that's the wrong answer. And so then what I try to do is I come up with another way to think about right. And that's where I always step in the muck, because in a way it's sort of impossible to talk about what that right is pointing to. But I'll say, why don't we think of right as what is? Just what is. So learn what is right. Learn what is. And that is what is as opposed to what we think it is or what we believe it is or what we hope it should be. But instead, what is? That's right. And how do we learn that? And there's only one way you can learn that. That's to experience it. We are experiencing it. And so that's what a lot of this talk is going to be about, is how we're experiencing what is. But it is as if we're not. It's as if we're closed off from what is. We feel like we're out of touch with whatever it is. So you think about what I pointed out at the beginning of my talk, right? That we have expectations. We have ideas about how the world works. It's kind of a rough idea that we have, a cartoon version of the world, and then the world suddenly doesn't match it. And maybe we're depends again on the magnitude, but maybe we're at a complete loss as to what to do next. So learn what is right is to see, is to realize what it is that you, or what is that you're experiencing right now. Actually, when I discovered this passage in the Dhammapada, I had read a version. I decided ultimately not to use it because there was enough in there that I felt I was going to have to fudge around with it. But it was kind of like they took this chapter and they turned it into a poem. They condensed it down into a much smaller teaching. And the way that they put learn what is right, they translated that as first establish yourself in the way. And I liked that because, again, our practice, the way, the Eightfold Path, is to realize what is. That's our practice. So establish yourself in that way. Be mindful. Be meditative. I say engage in right action, but some of this starts to put a little bit of a me in there that's doing things. But there's right action, right speech. There's right wisdom or right seeing, right intention. And so first establish yourself in the way. So if you look then, what it is first take up this practice. Realize what is. And then teach others as the wise do. So the next line that Buddha says is, before trying to guide others, be your own guide first. So teachers of the Buddha Dharma, they're not just academic teachers. They don't read about this. They don't balance arguments out and then try to put forth an argument. This is a practice. This is the way. This is something that the teachers take up. And then they point toward direct experience. And again, this is not to say then that the teacher is somebody who's landed in the end zone that we might call enlightenment. And from there, they're calling everyone in. Instead, they're establishing themselves in the way. They have to be, like all of us, vigilant in every moment. Be vigilant. Be vigilant in any watch of the night, at any moment, being vigilant. Coming back to this, coming back to what is. And then the Buddha says, it is hard to learn to guide oneself. And this is one thing I think that sometimes we intellectually struggle with, because we'll hear a teaching that our practice, this practice, the Buddha way, is to realize what is. And in one way, you can't imagine anything that's simpler. This is what is. I mean, how can it be any other way? How can we but be experiencing that? And yet, as I said before, we feel as if we're out of touch with something. Something feels out of kilter, something feels out of whack for us, and it's as if we're not in tune. So we understand this teaching is very hard to learn to guide oneself, but it doesn't make sense if all we're really doing is realizing what is. How could that be so hard? But, you know, it dawned on me that the reason this is so hard is that distraction is very distracting. So we get caught up in conceptualizations of the world. And again, it's just sort of the way we might encounter the world. We conceptualized it and we accept those conceptualizations as an expression of reality, not an expression of reality. We accept them as reality. We think that we're seeing something that we're not really seeing. We're giving solidity and substantiality to the appearances that come and go before our eyes. And so that's why it's hard to learn to guide oneself. We just get distracted. You know, when something is right there in front of you, you do this thing where you go, where is it? You know, you put the glasses on top of your head, your sunglasses, and then you run around the house going, where are my sunglasses? Right? And they're right there. Or you think about, what is it, Edgar Allan Poe's story, The Purloined Letter. I don't know if you ever read that, but the police are looking for this incriminating letter. And they're looking all over this guy's apartment, and it's just sitting right out in the open. Right? And that's why they can't see it. And that's our tendency, is we just think it's more complicated than that. We get caught up in our distractions and our ideas. And here we are then. It's hard to learn to guide oneself. It's easy to get distracted. You sit in meditation, especially when you first take this practice up. And there's monkey mind, which when I first heard that phrase, monkey mind, it made me laugh with such delight because, you know, you can picture monkeys and they're just going from one thing to another. I have squirrels in my yard. They're kind of the same thing. You know, they'll chomp on something for a while and then that thing just they toss that aside and they go running after something else. And maybe they start chasing each other around for a while. And that's why it's hard to learn to guide oneself, because we're so busy sort of creating, I don't know, chimera and chasing those around. We look right past what's right in front of us. And we do this all the time. We do this all the time. It's part of the great human comedy, part of the great human tragedy. Now, Buddha Bhuvasani says, your own self is your master. Who else could be? With yourself well controlled, you gain a master very hard to find. So we have your own self as your master. Who else could be? And, you know, we get to this question then, your own self is your own master. Who else could be? And if you really sort of look at this situation, again, if we think of this in terms of egoism, it sounds like we're talking about solipsism. It sounds like we're talking about, well, there's no one else in the world but me. But if we can get out of thinking in those terms, just stop thinking about it. We don't even have to put anything in its place. We just stop thinking about this. And we just see what's showing up. Your own self is your own master. Who else could be? Look at your situation. And perhaps you start to realize what Travis Bickle was asking in the movie Taxi Driver. He goes, you talking to me? I'm the only one here. Right? So Bickle, of course, is he's ego. He's talking about the ego there. But if you just look at what's showing up, what else is showing up here? I think there's maybe Travis Bickle wasn't the best. He was not really a Buddhist monk. So maybe he wasn't the best example. But let me refer you to a teaching by Dogen. This is a teaching I've cited on a number of occasions that I think is really a great teaching. It's from the Tenzo Kyokan, which is Instructions for the Head Cook. That's one of those books where you just, if that's you hear that Dogen wrote a book called Instructions for the Head Cook, and it does not have recipes in it. I'll tell you that right now. So it's not a recipe book. So you hear something like that and you just go, oh yeah, that's got to be a thrill. And it is such a rich teaching. I bet outside of perhaps the Genja Koan and the Fukan Zazengi, Tenzo Kyokan is the Dogen teaching I've probably read more than anything. And it is just rich with pointers. And there's this teaching that gets to, again, to what I think Buddha is talking about with your own self is your master. Who else could be? And I'll just read the passage from Dogen. He says, when I was at Mount Diandong, a monk called Lu was serving as the Tenzo. One day, after the noon meal, I was walking to another building within the complex when I noticed Lu drying mushrooms in the sun in front of the Butsudan, which is the main hall. He carried a bamboo stick, but had no hat on his head. The sun's rays beat down so harshly that the tiles along the walk burned one's feet. Lu worked hard and was covered with sweat. I could not help but feel the work was too much of a strain for him. His back was a bow drawn taut. His long eyebrows were crane white. I approached and asked his age. He replied that he was 68 years old. Then I went to ask him why he never used any assistants. He answered, other people are not me. And if you don't wake up now, if you don't take care of this, who else? Who else will take care of this? But again, this isn't that ego sense. You say something like that, and you can start to maybe panic and think, well, I can't do this. This is too much for me. Or you might feel alienated or alone. But again, if you really pay attention to your experience, that stuff drops away. You don't have to do anything with it. And then you can see, well, I was going to say, who else is there? But other people are not me. What is the experience that's showing up? Who's going to take care of this if you don't take care of this? Your own self is your master. You are the one that can, as he says, control yourself. So I wanted to look at that term master, because that's a complicated term as well. And, you know, it is a verb, it's an adjective, it's a noun. I'm going to look at the verb master, and then I'm going to look at a couple ways that we might use it as a noun. So to master something is to acquire complete knowledge or skill in, to gain control of or overcome. And this is pointing us back to learn what is right, to acquire complete knowledge or skill in. We might think something like that, especially when we hear to acquire complete knowledge, is that sort of academic or intellectual kind of knowing, that acquiring complete knowledge means that we have to read everything we possibly can read on a subject. I know that I spent a lot of my life doing that. Though I went to college, I was an autodidact in a number of fields. And then when I went to graduate school, I kept trying to do the same thing, just read and read and read and read. But acquiring the knowledge that is being pointed to in the Buddha Dharma, true knowledge, knowledge of absolute truth, we'll put it that way, so that it doesn't sound like I'm saying that knowledge that's book knowledge isn't some kind of knowledge. It is. But again, it's that provisional. It's like that sense of good. It changes all the time. You'll see that with each generation, there are paradigm shifts. Sometimes a way of looking at things or talking about things or understanding things goes on for several generations. But at some point, reality, we start to see the cracks in the way that we're looking at things. But this mastering, this acquiring complete knowledge we're talking about is really just realizing what is. That's realizing totality. That's not fragmenting the world up. So that master then is one who has acquired that complete knowledge. And again, we all taste this complete knowledge in every moment, but it's whether or not we realize it. And so then we get back to the question of the master too, as somebody who, again, is how did this translation put it again? Somebody who has established themselves in the way, in this practice that we have. And so then a master then is one who has acquired that knowledge. I'll just put it that way. Again, it's not that this is somebody who has reached the end zone of enlightenment and there they are, and that's what we're talking about as a master. But a master instead is somebody who takes up this practice and just keeps coming back to this. But a master is also a teacher. And so then you start to ask yourself, well, what is the master here? What are we talking about? So again, we think master, we start to think of a person, we start to separate things out. I'm a student, that person's a master. But when we look at the situation we're in and we're our own master, what is that pointing to? And what is the teacher here? We'll hear people say that reality is the teacher. It is the teacher. Maybe not in the way we think. It's not going to have lesson plans for us. That reading group that I was talking about, that we've gone from now having a free discussion to people have been getting lately, as you might imagine, some people are upset. And so now we have these rules set up, you know, and we have like, I don't know. It's just becoming complicated. I'll put it that way. And then that's not how reality teaches, right? The master that is reality just teaches continually. It's just revealing itself continually. And it's there if we're vigilant. It's just there. It's revealing itself. I stop myself from breaking this up, because again, the tendency is to want to say, and then we can learn from this lesson. But if we start to think of it in that way, if we start to separate this out, and it's a real easy tendency to do, it's really hard to talk about this without putting a subject in. And then once you got a subject, then there's an object. But the teacher is always teaching. Reality is always teaching. The master is always teaching. So your own self is your master. Who else could be? With yourself well controlled, you gain a master very hard to find. And so that master is reality. Yourself is reality. That complete, thorough knowledge, that's just realizing reality. And I say just realizing reality. That's one of those things when you hear it, you just go, I don't know what that means. What does that mean to realize reality? And if you start to get into that zone, because it's very easy to do that, just calm down because you're already doing it. Right? You just have to stop saying, well, I'm not, I'm, what am I, how, where do I get this? Remember, it's right in front of your nose. The glasses are on top of your head. The pencil's behind your ear, right? It's right here. We can just settle down, calm down. And then with yourself, well-controlled. And well-controlled is just, you know, our meditation practice is just to come back to this. You gain a master, very hard to find. And it's very hard to find, again, because the way we usually find things is to look out. And the teachings here are to come back to this moment. So now I'm going to jump again to the end of this. It says, by oneself is unwholesomeness done. By oneself, one is injured. Do not do what is unwholesome, and suffering will not come. Everyone has the choice to be pure or impure. No one can purify another. So we just have this, you know, your own self is your own master. Who else could be? And then we get this, by oneself is unwholesomeness done. And now we kind of get at the heart, because it sounds like, perhaps that sounds to our ears like there's a contradiction there, but there's not. And this is something that frequently happens with the teaching of the awakened, is when it seems that there's a contradiction and we want to figure out what's going on, or we want to point out and go, that's what I did when I first encountered some of these teachings. I was like, all right, there's a contradiction. They just undid their own argument right there. Just remember, these teachings aren't presented as an argument. And so when it is that we think we're encountering a contradiction, we're going to go, right, there's a contradiction. Instead, that's an opportunity for you to look at what assumptions you've just brought to this teaching. Because again, these are the assumptions that we normally bring to the world. And these are the assumptions that when we ask, what can one do? What can I do right now that makes that feel so hopeless, is that assumption that you're doing this by oneself, in the sense of me, myself, and I, as opposed to your own self as your master. I shouldn't even say as opposed to. It's just what's happening is you're confusing what is showing up right now. You've come up with a label that you might call George. You're coming up with a label that is a label of this experience. Now I'm gesturing around like that means anything, but it's the experience that is showing up, and then we conceptualize it. And then we have this idea of what oneself is. But this oneself, by which unwholesomeness done, that's that ego self. That's George, right? That's coming from that small place. And from that, unwholesomeness is done because it's coming from unwholesomeness, because it's coming from a sense of a self that is somehow separate from the rest of reality. Again, think about how it is that you move through the world. Do you think of yourself as, I'm going outside now. I'm going to do these things. I'm going to make some kind of change here. I'm going to, I don't know what it is, but just think how it is you automatically think about the world. And this teaching isn't telling you that's wrong, but it's saying, look at how you're going about the world, because that's the way we're going to go about it, and just assume that's the truth. And then we bump up against our own ideas. That's unwholesomeness. So by oneself, when it's me, myself, and I, when you see yourself as separate from the world, that's when evil is done. Or even when you have an idea of, okay, there's somebody else out there and I am one with them, right? Same thing. Still separating the world out. There's still oneself. Then unwholesomeness is done. By oneself, one is injured. Do not do what is unwholesome, and suffering will not come. Do not do what is unwholesome. Do not act out of that broken up sense of the world. And that actually, I think, is as we move forward, as we ask ourselves, well, what do I do now? It's to remember that the way we tend to sort of by default think, and it's how we think the world is that I am going out and I'm going to do something. And again, we, in a situation like this, we might think, and I'm going to do something good, So just the invitation is to notice that that's what's showing up. It's not even to have some ideas of good and bad. Of course, we know that, you know, again, provisionally, some things look like they're good and some things look like they're bad. And, you know, you don't want to do the good thing. When you're doing the good thing, you want to be aware of the fact that it's provisional. That's very important. You don't hang on to it. You don't clutch to that sense of good then bludgeon other people with that sense of good. So do not do what is unwholesome and suffering will not come. So if you don't, if you instead of, I'm going to come to another section here that will, I think, allow me to talk about this so I'm not repeating myself. I see it's getting a little late here. Everyone has the choice to be pure or impure. No one can purify another. So this is that moment, that pure or impure. Again, you know, I'm reading Eknath Iswaran's translation, and I like it because it has a nice flow to it, but sometimes it has language in it that can be a little misleading. And in fact, the Dhammapada often has language in it that people start to break the world up into. I used the word unwholesomeness before. This translation uses the word evil. So I avoided using that because, boy, that's a loaded word, especially in English. And so now we have, you know, everyone has the choice to be pure or impure. And we think, oh, we're talking about, again, somebody who's like holier than thou or somebody who's really bad. There's such a bad egg that they smell. I don't know. But that's not what we're talking about. When he's talking about pure or impure, we're getting back to that teaching that Steve pointed out last week. May we exist in muddy water with purity like a lotus. And like Steve pointed out, the flower of the lotus, even though it grows up in muddy water, it's not besmirched by mud. And even though we exist in muddy water, reality is not stained by mud. It can't be because it's not separate from the mud. The mud itself is reality expressing as mud. So that to be pure or impure really is just pointing to when we act, do we act from that sense of an ego self that is going out into the world and trying to do things. Again, we do this. This is how we navigate through our day. So some people hear this teaching and think they're being told then that you don't, I don't know, get a glass of water, you know, that you don't go through your daily life. What we don't do is cling on to that view. And this becomes very important when we start to ask ourselves, well, what can I do now? And if we really look at when that question arises, it's often what we're thinking is there's something out there that needs to be purified. There's something out there that I need to correct. There's something out there that I need to fix. And that's really where we need to look again. Now, do we step forward out of the intention to be awake, the choice to be pure, to be awake to what is, or impure? And impure is just hanging on to our notions about what's right and what's wrong, what's good and what's bad, that there's me and there's a world out there, that my actions are separate from myself. And that's actually that poem that I was going to read. I thought, and I'll maybe give a talk about that sometime. This is the second time I started writing a talk about that poem and abandoned it. I'm sorry, Thomas Tranströmer, I'll get to you at some point. But what that poem actually helps us to see is that our actions, again, when we're talking about self in that more open way, that is, your own self is your master. Who else could be? Our actions are self. I would even say we don't have to put that word self in there at all. And this is when we start hearing a teaching that Buddha has a teaching of anatta, of not self. Really, it's not that there's no self. And people understand that the Buddha taught there's no self. So you might hear, oh, yeah, this chapter on self. And my understanding is there's been a lot of debate about this, because then some people go, oh, he really was saying that there's a self. And other people are, no, he's pointing out there's not a self. But again, we have teachings that help us to see. Buddha wasn't pointing out that there's a self. Buddha wasn't pointing out that there's no self, but it's this not self. It's just, you can just let that self drop out of the equation. And that, realizing that, That's the choice to be pure, to wake up to what is, to not separate, to not break out, to not act out of that sense of ego. That's to wake up to what is. And then he goes on, and I think this is really important. No one can purify another. No one can purify another. So remember, it's your own self is your master. Who else could be? So all you can do is, excuse me, no one can purify another. You know, again, our tendency, our desire is to want to go out there and wake people up. Maybe you want to shake somebody and go, come on, get with it, wake up. But you can't wake somebody else up. In fact, if you do that, if you actually, I was going to say that doesn't work. But sometimes it actually does work. But just know that it doesn't always work to take somebody and shake them and go, come on, look at what's going on here. Sometimes when you do that, you actually put the defenses up. And people will read what it is you're showing to them in the complete opposite direction. So that this one professor I studied with once, who was a very well-known theater director, said that he was really excellent at pointing out to actors the mistakes or the problems they were having as actors. And he would point directly at and say, this right here is the problem you're having right now. This is why you're struggling with this scene. And he said the more direct he was, the more difficult it was for the actors to actually address the problem. Right? So it doesn't always help for us to go, come on, wake up, it's right here. I mean, sometimes I can just get people to not see it all. So you cannot purify another. That is actually each of us. And this is what, to me, is the freedom of this teaching, is we don't rely on a teacher. We don't rely on somebody to come along and wake us up. Nobody can do that. Only we can wake ourselves up. These teachings show us how we do this. So as we're now moving forward, if we're asking ourselves, well, what do I do now? What can I do now? Just remember, whatever it is that you do, first of all, you cannot purify another. And that, boy, that is something that we, I think, have a tendency to want to do. You know, think about if you're in a long-term relationship and you want to keep that person from leaving the cupboards open in the kitchen. You know, so you come up with some kind of method to keep the person from doing that. You can't purify another. You know that they need to see for themselves why that might be a problem. Maybe they need to bang their head against the cupboard or something like that. You only do this for yourself. Otherwise, it's really not, I don't know. It just becomes these pat answers. So it's one of the reasons I was a little hesitant to use the Dhammapada, because even as I'm talking about it, I feel like I'm using language that I've used before and you've heard other teachers use before. And it doesn't, you know, it just becomes more words. It sounds like we're saying, well, this is what all you got to do is this. And then you go, but I don't understand what it is that thing is that you're talking about. And that's because, again, no one can purify another. Only you can purify yourself. Only you can master yourself. And there's a really well-known story about this, the Zen master Kyogen. When he was a student, his teacher asked him basically, what is reality? And he went back to his books and he tried to find all, you know, the answer to, and he just couldn't do it. And so he came back and he told his teacher, he said, look, I don't know. I've looked through all my books. I can't find the answer. And so he asked the teacher, please tell me what it is. And the teacher said, look, it wouldn't be difficult for me to tell you this, but if you did, you would doubtless reproach me later. And so the student, you know, it feels pretty bad because he just feels like he just sort of failed some kind of test. He burns all his books. This is Kyogen, the Zen master Kyogen. And he burns all of his books and he kind of leaves us behind. And he's, I don't know, taking care of a temple. And he's sweeping the temple grounds. And when he sweeps, at one moment, a pebble hits a bamboo tree, and the sound of that, Kyogen wakes up. And in that, he has such gratitude toward his teacher for not giving him this answer that he might have then held around and go, yeah, all I need to do is do this, or reality is this. His teacher didn't give him that because his teacher can't give him that. So what is, if his teacher would have given an answer to him, again, he wouldn't have even been giving him an answer, but if he would have said something when Kyogen had asked, well, okay, I don't know the answer. What is it? All that would have happened there, what his teacher Isan realizes, is that Kyogen would have hung on to that. And then he still would have had to find out for himself what reality is. But now he would have had this impediment in his way. He would have had this thing that he's looking at going, okay, this is it, this is it, this is it. So there's freedom in the fact that no one can purify another, that only we can wake up. But it's something to remember as we go out in the world as well. So take up this way. Think about, again, how it is that the wise teach. I asked that earlier. The wise teach by doing. They just do. It's not what they are. It's just by doing. The wise teach by doing. And in doing, they set that example. And what is it that we do? Well, that's not a particular thing. That's not eating with your left hand. I do. That's not, you know, that's not like a particular thing that you do. That's not how the teachers teach. They teach by being grounded in this way, by coming back to now. So then this chapter ends with, do not neglect your own duty for another, however great. Know your own duty and perform it. And I hope now that that part doesn't stick in your ear. Don't neglect your own duty for another, however great. Know your own duty and perform it. I hope that you can hear in that, that this isn't asking us then to disregard others. It is, in that it's helping us to see that when we think of the world in others, that there are others that we need to purify, that we need to go out and help, that we need to go out and save. We're breaking the world up right now. And that when we've broken the world up right now, now what we do is unwholesome. Even if it's good, you know, it's unwholesome. So what can we do now is just to be aware of our conceptualizations and not grab hold of them. And so in not grabbing hold of them, we don't act brittly in the world and we don't end up churning up the muddy water or causing harm. So I knew at some point here I was going to have taken the whole hour. So thank you for your patience and sitting with me all this time. I guess if anyone does have a question or comment, we could probably take a couple of those right now. Otherwise, thank you. Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.